Blog Talk Radio.
Time it is off. What is going on here?
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it. Well, I am Dolly Air.
Good morning, everyone. The sun is shining. It's 40 degrees. It's really warm outside today. And I am so excited. I have four, and the fifth one's not here yet. Award-winning authors out. He just got here. And I'm going to let him in right now. And Jerry, we are live and on the air, and welcome. We have my favorite authors in the whole world. We have Charles Salzberg, Alan Topol, Bruce Coffin, Jerry Farrell, and one of my favorite husband's people in the whole universe, Larry Thompson. Morning, everybody. I am so excited and glad to have you here.
Good morning, Fred.
Morning, Fred.
And I have an announcement too. I got a contract for my new book yesterday. Publishing company signed it. And my new book, Silent Voices, is coming out on July 1st. So I am excited, too.
Congratulations.
Wonderful. Congrats.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, thank you. No, I rewrote it. I gave it a little bit of happy touch. Just a little bit. So the setting of your book... Yeah, I know. Kind of morbid. The setting of your book does not have to be a real place. It could easily be a fictional one. But when creating the setting, it's like creating a new character in your book. When creating characters, you have to have a profile, and you include the physical features, what they wear, vocations, hobbies, and interests. But when you're creating the setting, you have to do the same thing. So how do you create the atmospheric setting on the page that will lure readers into reading it? So sometimes people include the weather, the local customs, etc., and sometimes they get over carried away. So how do you create this in your novel without putting the reader, you know, telling them to turn the page and they don't want to read it? Now, as a reading specialist, I know that setting is not just where. It's a time period, when, time of day. So how do you create this in your novel? And how do you get the right mix? That's my first question for everybody. Whoever wants to start, go right ahead.
Well, this is Larry. I'll start. My books have multiple settings, as you know, Fran.
Yeah.
If you think about Dark Money, which is a couple of books back, it was in Fort Worth and it was in Austin, West Texas down in Pecos, Del Rio down along the Mexican border, New Orleans, New York City. So all of those were in my book, and I think that I want to say on any book, if I'm describing a character or a location, I'm going to say it in a few sentences at first, and then maybe add to it as the story develops. But I've always believed that you need to say enough about the setting for the lawyer, the reader, to then be able to fill in the blanks with their own imagination. So I can say something about a small town in Texas that will, in two sentences, that will help people understand where it is. And Texas is so broad. And so wide and diversified that you go from the piney woods of East Texas all the way to the deserts in West Texas, and I think that you can state that, though, I think in a few sentences, and then maybe add to it as the reader continues to read the story.
Yeah, Alan Topol, I want to echo what was just said, because I think it's important not to say too much or the reader will skim. But for me, as you know, Fran, I do international locales, and so there is no substitute to going to the place. I mean, my last book, Russian Resurgence, much of it took place in Budapest in Hungary. Italian divide mostly in Torino and in Milano. And, you know, I have to go there as the author. I have to spend enough time there that I can feel the place, that I can smell the place. And only then, when I have a sense of place myself, can I sit down and start to write about it. So I think, you know, the internet's great, research is great, but I think there's no substitute for being there and actually seeing and feeling what the place is like.
This is Charles. It's funny because I have the opposite thing. I write better about places that I haven't been than places I've been. And
really?
It's because
that's
interesting. If I'm too familiar with them, I don't think I get them as well as if I'm not. And the example I would give in the first Swan book that I wrote, it was Swan's last song, and it was written years and years ago before it was published. And it took place in New York, L.A., Mexico, and Berlin. And at the time, the only place I'd really been is New York. And so it was before the internet was built. I would talk to friends, and I would watch movies or this being based in those places. And I wrote it, and I gave it to a friend of mine. And he said to me, when we were there, and I said, I've never been there. Well, how did you capture it so well? And I was just able to imagine it from better, from doing some research. So for me, the less I know about the place, the better I can write about it, and I don't know why that is.
That's interesting.
This is Jerry Farrell, and first of all, let me weigh in first by saying that thanks for having me, and being that I'm a debut novelist, my first novel, I feel like I've been called up from A-ball to the big leagues with the other writers here. About setting, it's funny, there's one scene in The Last Sunk that takes place at the Mohonk Mountain House. Now, anyone who lives in New York is familiar with it. And my first instinct was to say, okay, I really need to describe this place pretty well for readers outside of, you know, the industry that I worked in. Of course, the novel takes place in the magazine industry in Manhattan. But then I began to think, okay, you know, Mohonk Mountain House, it almost does the work for you in a way. Even a reader that would be reading it from Nevada or something, I felt like I didn't have to overdo it. I didn't want to insult their intelligence by saying, you know, okay, it's a hotel built in, you know, the 1900s and this and that, and there's no TVs in every room. I felt like it could sort of people immediately get an image of, okay, this is a resort, upstate New York, and I didn't have to overdo it. So,
well,
Fran,
I thought it after you read it.
Pardon me?
Fran, I picked Portland basically because I had spent, as you know, 30 years working the street there, and I had toyed with the idea of picking up or making up a locale. But I thought it was sort of pointless to waste, you know, 3 decades of experience knowing the good and the bad of the city. And I wanted the city itself, Portland, to be a character in the book and really paramount to who my main character, John Byron, is, having grown up there. So I thought it was a good way to be able to incorporate modern day Portland and then also the historical elements of it.
No, I agree with
you. We like to talk about our own books, understandably, it's Alan. But I want to point out is there's a writer, Donna Leon, who's written about 24 or so books, maybe more, all of which are set in Venice. they're mystery sort of suspense books, and all I can say is nobody does a better job of setting than she does. If you've never been to Venice, you end up really knowing Venice from her books. I mean, if somebody wants a sort of tutorial, one of your listeners, I mean, that apart from the books of all of your five wonderful guests, our books are a master of setting.
That is good. Well, let's bring a character into this, too. Go on, Larry.
This is Larry. I just want to comment that I'm on the side of, I come down on the side that if you're going to write about a place, you need to visit it, look at it, smell it, walk the streets, and so forth. You know, my last book was White Witch, was set in Jamaica, and I spent a week down there scouting locations, talking to people, and so forth, and I think that was probably invaluable. One example I'd give that I think is everybody would know as far as the setting is Tom Clancy's The Hunt for the Red October. And he described a nuclear submarine, and he spent 50 pages thereabouts describing the inner workings of the submarine. Now, some people love that, and they think it's just wonderful to read through and understand all that. I guess they're technically oriented. But I read that, and I frankly, after about five pages, I skipped to the next action scene, which was 45 pages later, because I thought it was way overdone. So I think Tom Clancy was hugely successful, so I can't be too critical of him, because he made a lot of money when he was alive. But I think that you can't overdo it with a setting, for sure.
Well, I reviewed that book. I agree with you, unfortunately. But I reviewed the new Tom Clancy with Mark Cameron. Did anybody read that? The Power of Empire? And his last one was fantastic also. I interviewed him. And he's got a lot of characters in this book, like about 50. So that's the other way of writing Tom Clancy. So you have a central... Go on.
I wanted to say, so this is Charles. Years ago, I reviewed for the New York Times one of the Clancy books, and I gave it a really bad review. I totally agree with you. I mean, that turns me off about, you know, all that you know, description. And a friend of mine, do you realize that you gave a bad review to a guy who has access to weapons? I felt the same way.
Oh,
I
God.
Thought 200 pages shorter would have been a better book.
Yeah, I agree. This is Jerry. I agree, too. I'm a big fan of Elmore Leonard, and I kind of followed him, his advice on, he calls too much exposition, whether it be on the weather or anything, too much description. The word he coined, many of you probably know it, is hoop de doodle. And, you know, anytime you're going into hoop de doodle, which Tom Clancy was, I suppose, the master of, you know, Elmore Leonard might have thrown the book across the room.
Well, his great line was...
I'm a big fan of Tom Clancy's 10 Rules of Writing, particularly the one that says, cut out the parts the reader's going to skip anyway.
And when I have to review 800 pages, it gets kind of good. The only good part is, like, they have large font, so seriously. Oath of Office was really good that Mark Cameron wrote. He's got a different twist to Jack Ryan, senior and junior. So I'm curious to know what anybody thinks about that one. And the original person that took over was Mark Greene, and I just finished his book, Mission Critical. That was also, what I really like is that if you're going to have a book that's going to have 90 characters, he had a character analysis at the front of the book so that if you forget how to spell the character's name, you're there. So think about what is beyond the central or main location. When the characters look out the window or driving to a destination, what is it that they want to add to the storyline? Where do they head out on a day out? And what are some other key locations? Do you ever get lost where you have too many locations? And how does what the character's occupation is, like Craig Page is CIA, and he's a spy sort of, and a race car driver, and Henry Swan is a private eye, and John Byron is a detective, and Larry and Joe have different characters. How does what they do fit into the setting of what you're doing? So it makes sense. Because that's hard for me.
Well, this is Charles. I'll start. I'll give two quick examples. One of the books I wrote, Devil in the Hole, which was based on a true crime in New Jersey, but I changed it to Connecticut, and I didn't change it because I didn't want people to mix it up. I changed it because the horrible crime, a man killing his family and then disappearing, those kind of things happen in New Jersey all the time. So I changed it to Connecticut, to a town in Connecticut, for that reason, because I wanted it to be an unusual kind of crime. And then for Second Story Man, it's a master burglar, and I needed to set it in two places for a very good reason, and that is that in the winter, he's down in Florida or the South, because that's where all the wealthy people go in the winter. And in the summer, he's back up here in the Northeast. So that sometimes the plot dictates where you're going to set it, and sometimes it's the character itself.
This is Bruce here, Fran. One of the things I like to try and do is give a historical reference to landmark as Jan is driving from one place to another. So I'm not just listing out the streets. I've actually got a purpose, you know, behind saying what it is he's seeing as he goes from one place to another. Mm. And sometimes it's not just the historical aspect of the city as much as it is what I think a lot of police detectives actually deal with, which is I can't point out an address in Portland to you, or I can't associate something bad has happened there. And I think that's one of those things that really helps you identify as a reader with the main character, that he has these historical references or tough cases that he worked as he's going by different landmarks.
Well, I agree, because sometimes I feel like I'm right there with John, you know, solving the crime. And, of course, when Charles sends poor Henry somewhere, I feel bad for him just on the plane ride alone, seriously. So if your character and the plot foundation...
I'll give you an example.
Go
ahead, Brad.
No, go ahead, Larry.
I was just going to give an example. The book I'm currently working on, I have my protagonist, Jack Bryan, who's from Fort Worth. He's got a client on death row. Death row in Texas is in a unit called the Polunsky Unit, outside of Livingston, Texas, and Deep East, Texas. And the best way I could describe the culture in that area was that Jack was driving to the prison and ruminating about the fact of the horrible hate crime of James Byrd, a black man who was tied to the bumper of three white men's pickup truck and dragged to death only 30 miles away from there. And that was just 20 years ago. And so you have that undercurrent of racism in East Texas that exists to this day, I'm sorry to say. And that was, I think, a vivid way to describe what that environment is like.
Well, I'm going to be interviewing the guy that works, created the Texas Innocence Project on June 6th, and he wrote Confessions of an Innocent Man, a guy on death row, and what he does when he gets out. And this is based on basically a true story. And then tomorrow, I don't know how many of you heard about Alice and Gerald and the murder in Colorado. They took him 39 years to get him. The author's coming on the show tomorrow because he actually interviewed Gerald. And
Who's the Texas lawyer that you're interviewing?
David R. Dow, Confessions of an Innocent Man. And it's, he doesn't believe in the death penalty. And I guess it's a Texas Innocent Network and the Juvenile Capital Advocacy Project. And he does not believe in the death penalty. And he represented well over 100, I'm reading it from the press release, death row inmates during their state and federal appeals. I don't know how many, and I am going to ask how many he was able to overturn, but it's interesting because, you know, you wonder. You have the death penalty and somebody kills somebody, and then we're paying for them to be in jail for all these years. I'm not going to voice an opinion on that one. I'm just going to listen. But, that's going to be kind of an interesting discussion that day. So if plot and character are the foundations – How do you make sure that they're working in tandem? And plot is the external conflict, so you don't want the plot to get overrun by the setting. So the bad versus the good, how do you handle the plot on the scene level? How do you handle what's going to happen in the story and yet have the scene, you know, take some kind of precedence while you're discussing it? Because sometimes, like I say, if they talk about the trees and the fountains and whatever, I go like, I don't have to read that. I don't need to know it.
Go ahead.
I'll just comment that I do not like books where the writer has somebody walk into a room, and
mm-hmm.
then we have 3 pages of detail down to the last teacup of what the room looks like, and then my eyes glaze over, and I just want to get through it. I think you can again set the scene in a matter of a few sentences to let the reader know what the scene looks like, and I don't think it takes a lot more. Let the reader use his or her imagination.
I totally agree, and I feel that way about characters too. I don't think I've ever described what Swan looks like, and that's purposeful. I'd rather have just the way you said it. I'd rather have the reader use their imagination to think about what he looks like from the actions and from the way he speaks and the way he moves. So I totally agree, and there are. I know my friend Reed Farrell Coleman does the same thing, and there are others who like to describe the character down to, you know, what they're wearing any time, and that's fine. It's just not the way that I work. So I totally agree with you. Less is more.
Yeah, I agree too. This is Jerry. That there's just a small scene in my novel where the protagonist goes into a greeting card store. You know, suburban greeting card store, and I just said, you know, the jangling door chimes went off. He went in, and there's a Pakistani couple. One is dusting dusty, unsold greeting cards, and the other is, you know, drawing lotto numbers on a dry erase board. You don't need to describe what the couple is wearing. You know, I obviously. People can picture a Middle Eastern shop owner on their own, so I don't feel a need to, you know, talk about the crease in his slacks.
In terms of setting, I used to be a magazine journalist, and I taught magazine writing. And when I would teach it, I would say to the students, if you're doing an interview, only describe the place in the interview if it somehow pertains to the subject of the interview. So if you grab someone and you're just you bring them into an empty room that doesn't reflect them in any way, there's no need to describe what's in the room unless the person interacts with that. However, if you're interviewing them in their house, it is relevant to describe some of what's there, because you can find out something about the character by the case they have. So for me, that's the rule that works. I only do it if it's necessary to the plot character or the character is going to interact there.
So then how would you describe, like, Bruce is a police officer or whatever, and everybody has some kind of crime scene. So how much of a crime scene would you describe in a setting of a story when the police come? Because sometimes I go, like, how many times are you going to describe what the body looks like or whatever, and when is it too much to describe it?
Bruce here. I think it has to be relevant, Fran. It's the same idea. You can overdescribe. If I'm giving it to the reader in a descriptive form, that I'm giving it to them to identify the shock value or to see what it would be like to actually be there on scene and what you're observing, or whether if it's key to the actual case itself. I mean, there may be a detail that doesn't seem relevant at that point in the story, but later on it becomes very key. So other than those two things, I don't see the point of over-describing even the crime scene.
No, I agree with you. But so I've read like 10,000 books, and sometimes the crime scene doesn't seem like it's described the right way. I mean,
Fran, okay, this is Alan picking up on what you said. is that one thing, and this is a small footnote to our discussion, it almost seems stupid to say, but it's terribly important to get your descriptions accurate. The reason is, I mean, once I'm in Washington, I live in Washington. Once I read a book in which somebody had one of their characters getting out of a cab on 16th Street in front of the State Department. Well, guess what? The State Department's not on 16th Street. Now, it's more than that inaccuracy that really is galling to the reader. But then you begin to suspect everything the writer's written. So, I mean, I really got to put a premium on being accurate on your location stuff, or you're going to alienate the readers and turn them off. And I think that's a sort of a small point, and it sounds obvious and intuitive, but I really think it's an important point. And your comment, Fran, just really got me thinking about it.
Yeah, well, I reviewed a book, and I refused to finish it, where the police officer that's a captain asked a retired police officer to handle the case because he didn't know how to do it. And then he was digging out the bones of the body, and he had his wife bring him the bones.
Okay.
And I said, this is so, I refused to read it. I said, this is so ridiculous, and it made no sense. So what do you do with that? I mean, I literally told the publisher I'm not reading the book, and I didn't want to give him zero stars because it was so inaccurate. So, I mean, seriously, how do you handle that when you get a book like that, besides the fact that I won't read it?
That's how you handle it.
I think you've answered your own question.
I did the right thing. they weren't too happy with me, but I didn't care. I didn't really care. So what happens from the plots that you start out, external and internal conflicts, how does the conflict in a story relate to the setting of the story? And what happens when the character's internal conflict must impact with the setting? How does that drive it? Is there ever a setting where you just set up the scene so much that there's so much tension that you know something's going to happen? Like in every one of your books? All of you? Especially Larry?
Well, I know. I think if in my last book, which was a deviation from my normal legal thriller, was quite well set in Jamaica, and one of the locations was a town called Acampong, which is up in the mountains above Montego Bay, and it's the home of what's called the Maroons. They were descendants of slaves who escaped into the mountains in the 1500s and fought the Spanish first and then the British later on, and finally they got a peace treaty with the British. And I think as soon as everybody has, all of the characters in the book that are locals have told my protagonist that you mustn't go up to a compound because they do not like strangers, and particularly they do not like white men. So he ignores that, and he drives up to a compound and meets with their tribal leader, and ultimately nothing happens to him, at least not early in the book, not the first time. Later on something happens, but there is that anticipation that he's driving to a place that he knows may be problematic, but he does it anyway. And so the reader is going to go along with him and see what happens up there. And I've been on that same road, and I've been to that same town. In fact, when I was researching the book, my son, who put me onto the story, went with me, and we came back down from there, went to the hotel, and the bartender at the hotel says, "You shouldn't have gone up there. No white man goes up there, and I'm surprised you got back safely." Well, we did, and so I incorporated that into the book.
That I know, I got that. I was like, oh my God. That was really interesting. Well, anybody else on that one? That was a tough question.
Charles, I don't. I'm the kind of writer that doesn't know what's going to happen on the next page or the next paragraph, And so for me, it's very intuitive where, for instance, Swan is going to go next or anything else I'm writing. But again, for me, there needs to be a reason to set things in some place. And you guys who do these places, what I would do is I would sit down with you and talk to you just in a conversation about Portland or about any of these places. Some reason for me, it imprints on my mind more that way. But I know that I'm kind of unique, and most people do to get that feel of it.
That's interesting. So
yeah, this is Jerry. I'm a bit much more like Charles too. You know, kind of intuitive, and you know, I in the last thunk, it was supposed to wind up with a madcap scene on a rooftop, and it wound up in a basement of a suburban home. So don't ask me how that happened, but so it's just kind of the ride you go on.
Well, the setting sort of helps the plot too. It just drives the plot, and sometimes the main theme when you're writing your novel, the main theme of the novel, or it's whatever the issue is that you want to think. But when you have the setting, sometimes you come up with things like love conquers all, hate will destroy, or truth is vital, deceptions, crime does not pay. How does the theme or the plot come into the setting of the story? I mean, because I get everything pretty much that everybody writes, they tell me. And sometimes I'll say, well, in one particular book, I said the setting seems so sad it should fit that the characters were upset because it was raining, it was cold, it was dank. How does the weather, ever come into play? Because that's part of the setting, too. And sort of set the tone for what's going to happen in a novel?
I don't know, Pam. It's Alan Fran. I'm not so big on the weather stuff, but on your first question of how do you know, how does it interact with your plot? Since, as you know, I write international thrillers, and so in a sense, the setting is sort of becomes as much pivotal to the story itself. I mean, in Italian Divide, it was those places in Italy. Is what gave rise to the story and support the action. So, in a sense, at least on international books, there's a huge interaction. I mean, the story couldn't take place anywhere else. Mm. So, Italian history and current events is driving the story. So, in that respect, I think it is important. You know, but I don't, the weather thing doesn't make much difference for me typically, but other people who are doing books that are more, you know, something set out in the wild, for example, it may be more significant for them.
This is Charles, I don't necessarily think the reader has to know what the weather is, but as the writer, I have to know what the weather is, and I have to know what time of year it is. Because it reflects the way people behave and what they wear. You know, wearing a heavy coat. But I don't do weather usually. I mean, I'll mention if it's raining or something. But I totally agree. Is for me, weather is irrelevant for the book. But as a writer, I have to know what the weather is, so in case I need it.
Well, you don't write usually like, Goldblatt is wearing this, or Swan's wearing that. But I have to tell you, I could tell you what Goldblatt looks like pretty much because he likes to eat. That's all I'll say. But he's one of my favorite characters. I'm sorry, he's a riot. But yeah, a lot of authors have been using weather, and it like detracts from the plot. I mean, if there's a storm coming, you can say there's a storm coming. But how much of a storm in 20 pages do you have to write? Seriously.
Right.
I mean, it's
sort of loses
something.
This is Jerry. Like, again, we've all said it before, only if it's really germane to the plot. Like, in my book, it had to be in summer because, you know, it's in a steamy Manhattan, and the main character, in a few instances, you know, takes a cab only three blocks because he doesn't want to walk and sweat. So, it's, you know, you don't need to describe the heat, but the setting was, okay, it needs to be hot. you know, and so that's the extent for me.
No, I agree with
that's
you.
That's a really...
Go on, Alan.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a good point because the setting explains the fact that it's raining and steamy is why he took a cab. And then suppose something happens to him in the cab. Mm-hmm. So the weather's really driving your story. But, you know, sometimes it seems like just a useless sentence to say it was hot, it was cold. I mean, it's June in Manhattan. What do you think it's going to be? I mean, you know.
Well, I have the prologue of a book in front of me that had a setting. And sometimes the author sets the tone of the book just by the setting in the prologue. In this particular case, I got it. But sometimes I'm wondering, like, you didn't need to put that prologue there, and then they go forward. It says, on the cinder block wall, 12 feet away from the bars to the cages where my prisoners spend their days. And he describes it in detail, every step of the prisoner and where he put them. This is from the book Confessions of an Innocent Man, when the guy gets out and he takes the prisoners of the two judges that put him away. So what do you think about a prologue that describes the setting and sort of sets the scene and creates the tension?
Well, let me just
case, he did. Scared me.
I write a beginning better than Raymond Chandler did about the Santa Ana winds, the first paragraph of that book, I'm not even going to try because you know, it would be really good to tell it in a way that is different from other people.
Well, I know that is difficult. I mean, my book that's coming out on July 1st. It's told from it's a very simple setting. It's a cemetery with people behind gravestones. Larry knows, and
that book, Fran. I know that book.
Yeah, I rewrote. As a matter of fact, I won't tell you who. Somebody read it and told me how to improve it so that I did the backstories of the characters, so they got to know the characters before they wound up dead. And basically it's someone did something wrong to someone and they wound up there and how they got there. And the other one is if you did something wrong, I'm going to get you. So what can I say? So what would you say are the important elements of writing a good novel and keeping the reader interested without putting them to sleep in a setting? And what is your definition of setting as opposed to what my definition might be, probably something different other than a cemetery? That's a
okay,
tough one.
You asked two questions there. One of them is how do you keep the reader awake, and then how does the setting play a part of that? I think we've covered quite a bit of that
discussion. What is the definition of setting? If a new writer were listening to the show, and they will afterwards, what would you tell them the definition of setting is? Because a lot of people have different perceptions of it. Everybody here has a different perception of it. I mean, I went to the cemetery and looked at the stones and said, if you could tell me why you're there, why are you here? And I made it an old cemetery that's falling apart. So what would you say the proper definition of setting is? There's a lot of different ways to describe it.
I'd say it's the environment in which the scene takes place. That's a very simple definition, but I really think that's what it is.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. You know.
That is good. Okay, so now I'm going to ask everybody a simple question because I have everybody's name on my paper here. Jerry, I read one of your books, the last one, and it's really good. And that's because Charles told me to read it, and I'm glad he did. The only one.
The only one so far. I'm working on the second.
Are you writing a sequel to that by any chance? Are you writing
a sequel? No, it's not a sequel.
Oh, good. Okay. I want to make sure. But why did you choose the magazine industry and office buildings? Why did you choose that as your main
it's a simple answer. Because the book really is inspired by, you know, my experience. And certainly there's a lot of my experience in the main character of Paul Cavanaugh. But then it went to entirely different, complete, you know, fictionalized places, which goes to Charles, you know, in intuitive nature that things just happen, and then it becomes really, you know, Paul Cavanaugh, the protagonist, truly his story. But to get back to your question, so that's why it took place in the magazine industry in Manhattan, because I did, you know, work for many years at Condé Nast, and that, back to the beginning of our you know, discussion here, of course, that's an easy setting to, you know, to simply describe a gleaming Times Square office building. It does a lot of work, and the reader doesn't have to imagine too much. And likewise, you know, inside, you know, a sea of cubicles ahead, you know, I don't feel the need to describe, you know, the fabric that the cubicles are made of or anything. You know, the reader can can really, the work was kind of done for me in many respects, and I could concentrate on the characters and the comedy.
Yeah, it was. It's interesting, yes. So, well, anybody else? Larry, you have so many locations. How do you decide on the locations of all of your novels? I know that you research it and you go there. So you just wrote something brand new. What's the setting of the new one? And I know it's not going to be the same setting as this one. It's different.
I really pick cities as the main location that have some personality of their own. I grew up in Fort Worth, and my Jack Bryant series is based in Fort Worth, although he travels widely. But Fort Worth is kind of the stepchild of Dallas. People think of Dallas, and then they think of Fort Worth. But Fort Worth is a city that's very proud of its heritage, and its nickname is Cowtown because they had the armor and Swift packing plants there in the north side of Fort Worth in the 1900s through about 1980 probably. And so the cattle were driven through the streets back in those days to the stockyards. So and then Fort Worth also has very proud of its motto, which is "Where the West Begins." And so I can describe Fort Worth, and it's just an interesting place to be. I have one of my other novels called The Insanity Plea is set in Galveston. Not very many people have written books about Galveston, but it's also a character unto itself, as it's an island about a mile offshore from the mainland south of Houston, and it goes back to the 1500s. Jean Lafitte the pirate used to have a base there. There were back when gambling was illegal, which still is in Texas, except for the Indian reservations. They had casinos in Galveston, and along with casinos came all the other things. There was a minor part of the mafia that made Galveston its home. So, in fact, you're talking about walking in a cemetery. When I wrote The Insanity Plea, I went to the main cemetery in Galveston and walked around myself and wrote down some of the inscriptions that go back just about to the Civil War. So that gave me a good insight into what it was. And I've been to Galveston enough that I know it pretty well. But then I've got small towns in Texas, most of which I've been to. I like to pick a location that has its own character that is worth describing. Of course, I ended up in Jamaica on this last one, and it's a fascinating place. And so you kind of get into the underside of Jamaica. If you stay there long enough, you learn what the real people in Jamaica, how they live and what they think and so forth. So I don't just pick a city. I pick a city or a location that has some meaning. If you think about Dark Money, I've got a group of anti-government people out in West Texas, out in Pecos area. In fact, I picked Loving County in Texas because this giant West Texas county has a population of 81 in the whole county. So I picked that, and I have my anti-government guys out there living there so they can have peace, and they're preparing for the government at some point to attack them. And so they're far away from any civilization. And so I picked that as a place. And that's one thing, I actually didn't visit Loving County. I figured there's nothing to see because it's only 81 people in the whole county, and there's really not even an incorporated town. So I kind of winged it from there. So go ahead, Barry. I want to pick somewhere that's got some interest in.
Go on.
No, I think I'm through. Go ahead.
Oh, before I forget, because I don't want to forget, tomorrow at 10, Ron Frenzel will be here with Allison Gerald. What happens when your wife tells you if you don't kill your ex-wife and the two kids, she's going to divorce you? And the scary part is he won't tell anybody where the bodies are. 39 years, and they just got them recently, not too long ago, and the author interviewed him, and he won't tell anybody where the bodies are. It's scary. On Tuesday, at a special time, only because it's Robert Dagoni, the Eighth Sister, at 12 p.m. On the 15th, a phenomenal historical novel based on a true story of the Plains Indians, Redfish Oak, Jules Grutman, and George Putnam. On the 23rd, somebody that we all know and love, John Land, Strong to Seal. On the 25th, another person we all know and love, David Burnsworth, caught up in it. And on the 29th, an inspirational show based on their music, Trinity House Entertainment.inc, who are the ones that wrote the introduction to my show. Rachel and Michael will be here with their new song, Lord, I Adore You. And if everything goes well on the 17th, and we'll see what happens, Dylan Volk will be here. He has Asperger's Syndrome Spectrum, and we'll see if he can handle the interview. So I'm excited. Bruce, your locations involve crime scenes and police and department offices. How does this add to the power of your novels? And then I have a question for Alan afterwards.
Yes. I think it, you know, the idea for me at least is that I will try to do what I can to put the reader right in the action. So if it's a scene like, for instance, the most recent book, Beyond the Truth, deals with an officer-involved shooting right out of the gate. And so I wanted to put you in as the reader involved in the foot chase at night in the dark. Things aren't always clear. It's cold. You know, I've set it in January on purpose so you can experience Maine winter weather. And everything that can go wrong basically does. So for me, I found that very important to the story and as a way to be able to pull the reader right in to the action, where you can almost, you know, you can hear the crunch of the snow under your footwear. You can imagine trying to get over a fence and being in a dark alley, and all those things that would actually pull you in right out of the gate to have an experience that would be as realistic as I could make it.
And you do.
I can tell you, Bruce, I started reading that book a couple of days ago when I saw we were going to be on the show together, and I very much like your writing. I just haven't read that one yet. And I agree that scene is terrific because, you talk about the boots crunching on the snow and the winter scene, and then he has to go chase after the two bad guys, and I thought, boy, how do you climb a fence with all those clothes on in the middle of the winter? But I said, okay, I guess Bruce wrote it, it could probably be done. So anyway,
Bruce, did you ever do it?
It pulls you in for sure.
Thank you.
Bruce, did you ever
have to do that? Yeah, we have a lot of foot chases. It's amazing how hard it is to chase somebody that's wearing 25 pounds less equipment on than you are.
Oh, my God. Alan, you write two separate kind of novels. You have Craig Page and The Washington Lawyer. How do you decide which setting for which particular one? The Washington Lawyer is one place, and Craig Page is in many different places, except when he's racing his car. I like when he's a government person, but that's just me. So how do you decide on the setting for The Washington Lawyer? I mean, that's different, too. I like those books. I can't wait for that one to come out.
My Washington yeah, my Washington series, The Washington Lawyer, and then the newest book that's going to come out in a month or two called The Washington Operator, about a powerful lobbyist who's evil and venal, kind of like Podesta and Manafort. Those books have much more of a Washington setting. There's a little bit of an international flavor. I've lived in Washington a long time, been a lawyer here, a writer here, so I really want to get the Washington setting into those Washington books. Somebody told me, you know Washington, write about Washington. Mm. Whereas Craig Page, I've traveled a lot internationally, and whenever I'm going somewhere, I'm trying to imagine, do I want to put a book here, and if so, how? And then I'll go back for research. So it's that dichotomy, the Washington, much more the infighting, how our government really operates or doesn't operate, gives rise to the Washington thing, the venality of some of the people here, and are they, how they're affected by the setting. That's drives the Washington thing, and international events drive Craig Page, of course. So that's an easy sort of split for me, actually.
Well, the final question, because we have about 9 minutes, so I'm looking at my thing here. It doesn't matter if it goes over. The cover of your book, how does that relate to the setting, or doesn't it? Because sometimes I look at the cover of the book and I go, oh, my God, that's really scary, or, oh, my God, what is this book about? And the title doesn't always tell you what the setting of the story is. So how does the cover relate to the setting of the book, of all of them? I mean, Bruce, all I get is, like, the printed copy. I never see the real cover until I look it up, and I print you 5 stars, whatever.
Yeah. For me, it's really it's a team effort. There's a group that actually reads the book, and then they decide based on that. I fell in love with the first cover they did for In the Shadows. Which of course has the shadow of, or at least the silhouette of my protagonist in the foreground, and they've managed to stay with that theme, incorporating different parts of the city depending on what the story gives you, and I think they've done a really nice job of capturing the essence of what the story is about. It has a dark, gritty quality really for all of the books so far, and Guido Carotti and the rest of the team at Harper have done a fantastic job.
Yeah, they do. They are great. And they send me everything, even if I don't ask for it. They just sent me something brand new. That is fantastic. Yeah, Alifair Burke, The Better Sister.
Yeah, that's interesting, Fran, on your cover thing, because I picked up before the show, because I was looking at it in my book, Italian Divide, and it has the cover.
Yeah.
And then it has a very, as you'll recall, a very sinister-looking fellow who could be a mafia guy from the back. And so right away, you know, that gives you a sort of the foreboding that ties into the plot. So cover can help. It really can help.
Well, I'm looking at Charles' cover right here for Swan's Down. And let me tell you, you have to read this book. It's so great. It is really great. And the cover says it all. Seriously. I loved it.
Let me expand this a little bit to say it's not only the cover that's important. It's the title that's important.
Yeah, that too.
You've got to have a title that's going to cause people to want to take a look at it.
Fran, I'll tell you a funny story about the cover of the Swan's Down, which has got a crystal ball on it and tarot cards.
Yep.
And they did a reveal, and it was on Facebook, and a young woman I know wrote me and said, hey, at your book signing, would you like me to do a tarot card readings? So at my book signing, Mysterious Bookshop, she's going to be there giving free tarot card readings.
Oh, God.
So
that's scary, though.
Page thrower.
That's interesting, though. Are you going to have yours read? Charles, are you going to have yours read?
Am I going to have it read?
Are you going to have your tarot cards read? You are? You're brave.
I don't actually want to know what's going to happen.
Me too. I don't want to either.
Yeah.
I would be afraid. So where can we learn more about all of you and your work and what's next and when am I getting it? I mean, I think I did that to you, Charles. When you had the cover reveal, I said, where's my book? I've been doing that a lot. I got to stop doing that. No, not really. I did that a couple of weeks ago when Lee Matthew Goldberg, did anybody read the Desire card? It's fantastic. And I made a mistake because I thought he was Lee Goldberg. So I actually printed out his book because he sent me a PDF. He didn't have one. And I have to reschedule Lee Goldberg for an interview for Killer Thriller. If you haven't read it, you want to read it. It's hysterical. But this is phenomenal. So where can we find out about all of you and your work and what's next and when am I getting it so I can put you in my schedule?
I guess I'll go first, this Jerry, because I'm the rookie here.
Okay.
my website is ggfarrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L.com. And that people can learn more about the last thunk there. And I'm working on a follow-up working title called Tailspin, which also takes place in a corporate environment, at least at the beginning. Going back to your question about, you know, why office buildings, Fran.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked in a lot of corporate environments, and I like to kind of mine humor from pain, and there's no more painful place than a corporate office. It's a fun book, and look forward to it.
I'll go next. This is Alan Topol. My next book's Washington Operator, coming out in a month or two. I don't have a date yet. Fran, you'll immediately, of course, get a manuscript. Setting is Washington. My hero, Kelly Cameron's back, and as I said, it's about a very venal Washington lobbyist, and so I'm kind of driving that point home. And I've seen them in action, and now I'm going to try and write about one.
Well, then you're going to have to tell me when you want your interview, because I have exactly one date left in June, to be honest. I take off July, and August I start back on the 20th, because July is like my month to just read books and come to the Thriller Fest and see everybody, I hope.
And go to the beach.
Are you coming to the Thriller Fest, anybody? I hope.
I will be there.
Well, this is Larry. I'll be there this year.
That's good. I hope we do the Capitol Grill this time, too. That would be really cool for my anniversary. That would be really nice. So, Charles, where can we learn more about you and your work?
I think I introduced you to the Capitol Grill, as a matter of fact, Fran.
Yeah. The day we're going to be there from Friday to Sunday, the 12th to the 14th, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Where can we learn more about you and what? Are you coming, Bruce?
I am. We'll have to meet up.
Oh, yeah, we have to. Definitely have to meet up. You'll know me. I'm the one with the purple, green, blue, yellow, and red streaks. I'm serious. Seriously. No, seriously, that's the truth. It's a new color this time. So, Charles, where can we learn more about you and your work?
Well, you can call me up and ask me. And if you don't want to do that, you can go to my website, charlessalzberg.com, or on Facebook. I'm always willing to talk to someone about anything. But, you know, writers have this kind of life where no one really pays much attention. So my website or that.
And whose website didn't I get? I got Jerry, I got Alan, I got Larry. Did I get everybody?
Right,
I don't want to miss anybody.
You didn't get me.
Bruce, that's what I'm looking at.
You can reach me.
I'm writing initials.
Yeah.
Go on.
you can
I'm losing it today.
Boppin.com and find out more about me. The fourth John Byron book I'm working on right now, and it will be out tentatively it's set for January. Untitled.
Well, I'm writing it on my thing here, so I don't forget. But then, if I know Harper, they're going to send it to me anyway, which is what they do.
Right.
Doesn't really matter.
Good.
That's okay. So I want to thank everybody. I would like to say that Alan Topol, you're on another panel show in June. I'm doing one with Alan Jacobson, Lawrence Block, Lee Goldberg, Tess Gerrinson, and Stephen J. Schwartz on Hollywood and the author and what happened and their experience with sending their manuscripts to Hollywood. And Alan, this is the one that you're on the 19th with R.G. Belsky, you. Good, Fran. Philip Margolin, and that should be very interesting. And I think Alan Jacobson. There's going to be four people on that particular panel, and we're going to talk about strong female characters.
Right.
And that's going to be fun. As soon as I think I sent you the questions, and if I didn't, Just remind me, because I know I did.
Yep.
So I want to thank everyone. And if anybody else wants to
thank
join
you,
the craziness
Fran.
That day, you're welcome. Let me know.
Thank you, Fran, for having us. We really
thank
appreciate it, all of us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Very, thank you. Everybody
thanks,
have
Fran.
A great day. It's beautiful outside, and bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.